Senator Dick Durbin said a few months ago he doesn't support the Green New Deal. Has he changed his mind? And how do the rest of Democrats in our congressional delegation feel about it? Also, as one homeless shelter in southern Illinois closes, we talk about the challenges facing shelters across Illinois. Plus, it's college graduation season, and seven men from Stateville Correctional Center also just received their degrees at a ceremony that included a performance from Chance the Rapper.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. That's all coming up on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later today, homeless shelters can be one of the most important resources in a community. But what happens when one can't afford to stay open? We're going to talk about some of the challenges that shelters are facing across the state, from Springfield to Herrin to Evanston. And seven men at the Stateville Correctional Center recently earned their bachelor degrees through a program at the prison. It was the first graduation ceremony at Stateville in more than 20 years. But first, when the Green New Deal was first introduced just after the new year, it was met with both cheers and jeers. First, the cheers. Here's Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, one of the sponsors of the policy package, as heard on The Washington Post.
Because today is the day that we truly embark on a comprehensive agenda of economic, social, and racial justice in the United States of America.
There were also jeers, even some laughs, and not just from Republicans. Here's Senator Dick Durbin on Morning Joe on MSNBC.
Real quickly, Mitch McConnell is going to might bring up a vote on the new Green Deal, the Green New Deal, whatever they call it. How will you vote on that?
At this point, I would be, I can't tell you, to be honest with you. I've read it and I've reread it. And I asked Ed Markey, what in the heck is this?
You sound like Nancy.
He says...
And there were plenty of other reactions. Why weren't we consulted? What will this even do? Well, a few months have passed, and the environment, particularly climate change, continues to be an important issue for many voters. So where's our congressional delegation now, at least the Democrats in Illinois, when it comes to the Green New Deal? And what would you want to tell them? You can text us. Our number is 217-394-5765. Save that in your phone. That's always the way you can text us. 217-394-5765. Patrick O'Connell has been covering this for the Chicago Tribune. He's on the line from Chicago now. Hey, Patrick, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, great to be back. Thanks for having me.
So, Patrick, I mentioned some of our lawmakers were wondering what even is the Green New Deal, and I don't know if that's a little bit of posturing for the news shows, but there are probably a lot of people out there that who, in fact, do not know what the Green New Deal is. Is this a law? Is this a mission statement? Can you explain that for us?
Sure. So I think to the politician's point, it's probably both, right? It's probably, you know, some posturing on their part, but also it is kind of a nebulous, complicated set of proposals. And what it is it's designed to combat climate change. And but it is so wide sweeping in its goals and its aspirations that people like Dick Durbin are like, I don't know, like, what are we going to do? I don't understand. Is this going to be a law or not? It is not. If it were ever to pass, which seems at this point to be a long shot, especially in the Senate, where the Republicans are still in control, it would be non-binding. So nothing, there are no laws would pass or anything like that. But what it's trying to achieve is net zero greenhouse gas emissions. It's supposed to have policies that lean to cleaner air and cleaner water for residents, invest in clean, renewable technologies, and the idea of Ocasio-Cortez and Ed Markey and some of those that have signed on is that this could spur economic growth, but also you heard in the clip that you played, social and racial justice reforms across the country.
And so obviously Democrats talking about social and racial justice reform, talking about how to handle climate change, that's not new. Why has this become such a big deal?
Well, I think the short answer is that it's Ocasio-Cortez, right? AOC. I think that she's was such a rising star. I think her star has sort of risen and remained high. But she and others like her in the incoming freshman class of representatives, young women of color in particular, got a lot of attention from people like myself, but also from voters, right? And so I think she wanted to capitalize on that. She found a partner in the Senate in Ed Markey, and they went for it. They put this proposal out there. It got a lot of attention. And then people started looking at it and wondering, okay, sort of like you were asking, well, what does this mean? What does this do? Right. And so I think what's interesting is you have a lot of the Illinois delegation that has tried to walk a fine line between saying, hey, we, you know, there's some things in here that we like. There's other things in here that seem way pie in the sky. And only a few of them have actually signed on to it. So, right. So you're talking about Chuy Garcia, Danny Davis, Mike Quigley, Jan Schakowsky are the only Illinois Democrats to
all
sign
Chicago
on.
Area, no, right?
All Chicago area, right? Mm-hmm. No Republicans, of course. And then you had played the clip from Senator Durbin, and Senator Durbin, while he, as I mentioned in my story, made an appearance between at this youth climate strike, high school students who walked out of school to protest climate change, essentially. He gave a speech there. And what was interesting about that is that somebody, while he was talking sort of generally about the need to combat climate change and to reduce CO2 emissions and to take care of our planet, somebody shouted out, Green New Deal!
Right, which is kind of similar. Right, Patrick? It's very similar to, I'm thinking of Dianne Feinstein and the young people who approached her in her office. We know this is something that Illinois voters care a lot about. We certainly have heard this from our 21st audience when we were talking to people during the campaign. By the way, if you have thoughts on this, you can text us what you want your representative to know about the Green New Deal. That number is 217-394-5765. Patrick, what are the statistics say about voters and how much they care about climate change, particularly when we're looking at Democratic voters?
So I think Democratic voters in particular are very interested in this as a campaign issue. It may not be as high as healthcare or jobs, but it's up there. Pew Research noted that 83% of Democrats, compared with 27% of Republicans, view climate change as a major threat to the country.
That's a huge difference. 87% and 27%?
Correct.
Wow.
And in talking to Democrats themselves, like people like Sean Kasten, who comes in with sort of a unique set of experience in the CO2 business world, they're obviously focused on this. Even Durbin, while he's not ready to sign on to the Green New Deal, said after this rally when I asked him, you know, where do you think this is in terms of voters' minds? And he's like, it's super important. It's going to be part of the 2020 election. It is top of mind for Democrats. I think where it comes to be a little bit of not political football, but they need to make a calculation, especially in swing districts, places like the Illinois 6th District, Kasten's district, and a little bit farther out in the 14th where Lauren Underwood won, is where are the swing voters? Where are the less like left voters on not necessarily climate change, but on something as far-reaching as the Green New Deal? Mm-hmm. I think that's what the political calculus that the Illinois delegation is making, at least on the Democrat side.
We're speaking with Patrick O'Connell from the Chicago Tribune. He's done quite a bit of reporting on this. We're going to tweet out Patrick's story about this. And to your point about Representative Sean Kasten, he basically ran an entire campaign in the 6th on environmental issues. Clean energy was his profession prior to taking office. And Patrick, I just wanted to play some audio of a conversation I had with him in Washington in February when this was like right at the beginning of this, when I asked him about the Green New Deal. Were you involved with this?
I wasn't involved at all.
What do you think of it, the broad outlines of it?
I think it's being described as a policy document when in reality it's an outline of social outcomes. It's a document that describes a lot of socially nice things that I think a lot of us would probably support. We desperately need to lower CO2 emissions. I'm delighted it's causing that conversation. we need to have a conversation about the hollowing out of manufacturing jobs and middle-class jobs, and maybe it triggers that conversation. We need to have conversations about wealth inequality. I don't understand particularly how it actually coheres together into a whole as a policy document. And I do have some frustration because if you believe, as I do, that the top three most pressing issues on our species right now are climate change, then I think, at least in my view, I conclude a couple things. Number one, we need to pass laws today that are going to meaningfully reduce CO2 emissions. Not talk about laws, not talk about policies. We need to pass laws. Number two, we need to recognize what became painfully obvious to me in 20 years in this space. We suffer from a lot of unintended consequences of well-intentioned energy and environmental policy. We have almost no policies that reward people for growing the economy and lowering CO2 emissions. And having spent 20 years running companies with missions to profitably reduce CO2 emissions, I cannot tell you how many times the barrier to us doing more of that was actually a United States law.
That's Representative Sean Casten, back from an interview I had with him in February. Patrick, he sounds a little frustrated there. Does he still feel that way?
You know, I don't know if Casten feels frustrated. I feel like if I were to summarize where he's at, I would say he's a realist. And I think that his background in not only what he did as a businessman, but his background as a scientist gives him a unique perspective on this, where I think basically he thinks that some of the aspirational aspects of the Green New Deal are just too squishy and too, you know, like he was mentioning there, like, I think it's great. All these things are great, but, right? And so I think when you talk to him, as you and I have, he gets very granular into the nitty-gritty specifics about how CO2 emissions can be reduced, but also market forces. Like, what practically, how is this all going to happen, right? There's all these power, there's a power grid, there's power companies, there's electricity being generated by coal and by nuclear and solar and wind, and how do all of these things get together? And if you've talk to him, again, as you and I have, he's more than apt to give you detailed answers on all of this. And so I think maybe what his frustration is that he doesn't feel like the green policy proposals or ideas in a very broad cloud sense are ever going to get, not only are they practical, but they're never going to sort of get the time of day from those that are either in the middle or Republicans in general.
And when we think about that, by the way, we just got a text. Climate change is a problem. It's time to have a serious conversation about renewable energy and carbon emissions. The Green New Deal seems to me to be meant to start that conversation. Thanks for that text. By the way, when you text us, please give us your name and hometown. Patrick, is that a little bit, when we're thinking about the whole idea of this, it's really starting a conversation? But when we look at folks who've been in office for some time, I'm thinking of Senator Durbin, who was called the Green New Deal political theater. Senator Duckworth has also not signed on to this. Is there a sense that the folks who have been in office for some time feel like this isn't really what needs to happen in terms of actual change in our laws?
So, good question. I would answer the question this way. So, those that have signed on in the Senate include Bernie Sanders, Kirsten Gillibrand, Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, Cory Booker, Amy Klobuchar.
Everybody who's running for president, in other words, would it be faster
right.
if you said that?
So that's more than half of the they're all Democrats, of course, but more than half of those that have signed on are running for president. And so what does that say? I think it says that they are placing their bet on this as a winner issue for them among Democrats. And I think that there's a little bit of a difference between national politics and then politics on the ground. You know, here we're, you know, obviously focused on Illinois. And then also what is actually going to happen as we, as the texter mentioned, concretely try to deal with the things that are actually going to affect climate change. And I think that's the tricky aspect of all of this.
So when we're looking at the Democrats that have signed on, remind me, you said Quigley, Schakowsky, Who else has signed on to this and said they would support it?
So Mike Quigley, Chewy, let me get
Chewy
my
Garcia,
note here.
Jan Schakowsky.
Danny Davis, Mike Quigley, and Jan Schakowsky. Right.
Okay.
So those are the – and again, to your question about, like, where do we go from here, I don't think anyone really knows, right? It's just sort of hanging out there. This was February when it was issued or when it was – when they made the big announcement. And I think – part of the strategy was what we're doing right now, right? Talking about it, talking about what it means, what it could be. And that was part of the goal.
And I wonder too, Patrick, how much we see this energizing. You know, we talk a lot about Republicans playing to their base, President Trump playing to his base. Do we see climate change as a particularly energizing, especially for young voters on the left?
Yes, we do. And the numbers from that you asked about, you know, some polling about what Democrats are looking at, and some of the Democrats that I've spoken to referred me to some statistics about, you know, large percentages of all voters believe that the environment is an issue. They may not agree on what's happening. They may not agree on quote unquote climate change, but an issue like the Great Lakes restoration, right, is a winner across the board, including for Democrats, right? Like Peter Roskam, when he was running against Sean Casten, went out of his way to say, I'm for that, right? And so I think politicians realize that environmental issues, if to put it in that bucket, are very important to people in the Midwest, and in particular, younger Democrat-leaning voters.
Right. Well, we will see how this plays out, both for the actual Green New Deal and this conversation as we get closer to 2020. I want to thank Patrick O'Connell for being with me. He's a reporter with the Chicago Tribune. He's got a nice piece wrapping all of this up. Oh, and also thanks to Nick, who is the one who sent that text message, Nick in Carlinville. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. We'll be right back with you after this short break. Welcome back to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Most of us don't want to have to imagine a day when we would need to use a homeless shelter. But like with many emergency and social services, you like knowing it's there just in case. And usually that is the case. There are shelters all across Illinois that provide beds and support no matter the weather or the economy. But even these institutions are vulnerable. Molly Parker of the Southern Illinoisan recently wrote about one shelter that did have to close its doors in Heron in Williamson County. She's on the line with us now. Hi, Molly. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
We're going to tweet out Molly's story. It got us thinking about the challenges that shelters face all over the state and what we need to know about how these organizations not just serve their communities, but also how they're, in some cases, trying to just stay afloat. Erica Smith is with us as well from Helping Hands in Springfield. Betty Bogg is the Executive Director of Connections for the Homeless in Evanston. And Bob Palmer is the Policy Director at Housing Action Illinois. Bob, Betty, Erica, welcome. Thank you for being with us as well.
Thank you. Good
morning.
Molly, I wonder if we can start with Heron. What can you tell us about this shelter that closed down?
It was a long-standing shelter in our region. It ran quietly for many years, not flashy, didn't do a lot of really public fundraising, but just quietly served the community of Heron and Williamson County for 36 years is how long it was open. It's a small shelter, 18 beds, and emergency shelter is all they did. So we have a lot of programs that involve emergency shelters where the service providers are also doing food pantry, soup kitchen, financial assistance, but they strictly did homeless providing, you know, provided homelessness beds for families in the region that needed a place, had fallen on hard times and needed a place to stay short term.
Erica, can you describe for us, or can you just explain to us, so emergency shelters, I think Molly did just explain it, but an emergency shelter is simply just a place where people can show up at the last minute and have a bed?
Yes, it is. It's intended for people who are in housing crisis, and emergency shelters actually operate a lot the way that emergency rooms do for people who are in health crisis. They're a place where you go where you need immediate service and stabilization to get back on your feet, in this case, housed again.
Molly, what led to this shelter in Heron closing down then?
The director, Peggy Russell, she's been there for 20 years or so, and what she described to me was a perfect storm of challenges that came together here and finally forced them to make this difficult decision to close down the shelter in Heron. She discussed delays in the pass-through funding that comes from the federal government through the Department of Human Services. Because this is their only program, they have less diversity of funding. So they, you know, were waiting 7 months sometimes for reimbursement to flow through. It had to do with the fiscal year for the federal government starting in October versus the states and the timing of that. She talked about increasing competition for private dollars in our region. A lot of needs, a lot of social service providers. The private donations have gone down that they were receiving. United Way of Southern Illinois recently stopped among them, and they're one of many of our givers, but they stopped being able to provide to the social service agencies they had traditionally supported because their donations were way down.
So it is a lot of different factors here, it sounds like, Molly.
Yes, exactly. Minimum wage increase going up, causing, you know, other staffing issues and other things like that. So just a number of things hit them at once.
Okay. Bob, when we hear about social service agencies struggling for funding, certainly that's a common story. We've certainly discussed it many times on the 21st. How rare is it for a homeless shelter to actually shutter its doors?
Well, thankfully, it is fairly rare. But as you said, the issue of agencies really struggling and sort of going from month to month, barely able to pay their bills is very common. And groups are still getting over the state budget impasse where there was a lot of reduction in staff and services. So even if agencies are still open, they may not be providing the same level of services that they were, you know, 3 or 4 years ago or before the budget impasse.
Right. That's Bob Palmer with Housing Action Illinois. Betty Bogg is also with us, where she's Executive Director of Connections for the Homeless in Evanston. Betty, what kind of services do you provide for people in the northern suburbs of Chicago?
We started out about 35 years ago as a homeless shelter. We still run that very same shelter. It's more of a transitional model where folks don't have to line up every night to get their bed is saved. We have many services that we provide to people during the day for people living on the streets, trying to get them squared away, jump through all the hoops that you have to jump through to get into housing. We run our own housing programs, and then we work quite a bit in the area of homelessness prevention.
So I want to get to what that homelessness prevention looks like, but I wonder, Erica, if you can tell us a little bit about Helping Hands in Springfield. Is it we were just talking about the whole idea of an emergency shelter, and you were explaining that to us. Betty's explaining a little bit more of the comprehensive services that happen in Evanston. What about the kind of work that you guys do with Helping Hands in Springfield?
We are very similar to what Betty had described about their shelter. We have been in existence for 30 years here in Springfield. We started out as an emergency shelter. We have actually two shelters we run. One is year-round for men with 45 beds. The other is a seasonal shelter. It has been in the past of about 56 beds. We have a combination of that emergency shelter and what you might describe more as transitional bed model, in that we do have people who come who are there every night, but we also have beds that are available for people who show up. And we do provide a lot of the support services, the case management, getting IDs, getting help with Social Security, all of those kinds of things, with the intention of getting people housed.
Okay, so that's a little bit, when we say homelessness prevention, Erica, is that what we're talking about?
Yes, in some ways. Prevention has to be a key part of our approach, because if you build a shelter with a great, easily accessible front door, that's wonderful. But if you don't have that exit door to housing, your shelter quickly becomes overwhelmed and unsustainable. And I think that's what we're seeing in a lot of communities.
the overwhelmed and unsustainable part, Erica?
Yes, yes, because we don't have enough affordable housing and permanent supportive housing in communities. Without that, that's an important piece of homelessness prevention and diversion to keep people from getting caught in the cycle of homelessness, and then they end up using emergency shelter as permanent housing. And that's what can become overwhelming.
I do want to get to that prevention and the whole issue of affordable housing in a minute. But Bob, I wonder if you can help us understand a little bit more about funding. Molly was starting to talk about this. Is funding different from HUD depending on what type of shelter or what type of services you're providing?
Yes, and I should also say that I think a lot of the shelters out there aren't getting any government funding. They're just operated by churches or nonprofits or, you know, volunteers.
Is that the majority, Bob?
Well, we don't have an absolute list. I think most of the bigger shelters probably do have some sort of government funding, but there's, you know, a lot out there, and, you know, they kind of maybe only operate during the winter. In terms of those that do get government funding, largely driven by what's happened over the last 20 years at the federal level, there's been more of an emphasis, which makes sense, on getting people into permanent housing or preventing their homelessness in the first place rather than having people go to an emergency shelter. And that would work great if there were enough permanent affordable housing units and there was enough prevention or rapid rehousing resources. But unfortunately, there's not. So there's still a lot of people with emergency needs. And in many communities, when people call for a shelter, they're all full.
And how does this work in Illinois, Bob? Is the state divided up into different regions?
Yes. Well, at the federal level, they do the funding through a competitive process through what are called continuum of care networks. And there's 20 continuum of care networks. They vary in size. For example, the city of Chicago is one continuum of care. But then when you get to Southern Illinois, the Southern Illinois Continuum of Care Network covers 26 or 27 counties, which is a vast geographic area. And particularly in rural areas, there are a lot of challenges associated with that, transportation and a whole lot of other things that make it more difficult to serve people who are experiencing homelessness.
That's Bob Palmer with Housing Action Illinois. We've been speaking with Betty Bogg, Director of Connections for the Homeless in Evanston, and Erica Smith with Helping Hands of Springfield. Molly Parker is with us with the Southern Illinoisan, and she was sparked this conversation by writing about this one shelter in Heron in Williamson County that did have to close. Molly, when we think about what Bob was just saying, so that Southern Illinois region is actually, it serves the biggest region in Illinois. And we mentioned this Williamson County Center as providing short-term shelter. You were describing in your reporting about how the face of homelessness in Southern Illinois has been changing. Can you describe how?
Yeah, some of this is anecdotal at this point, but I think that other types of statistics would certainly bear this out as well. We're just seeing a lot of entrenched poverty, societal collapse that comes along with that. The things, you know, more grandparents raising grandbabies, even great-grandchildren that they're raising because mom or even, you know, grandma is in a bad situation of some type. Before, again, some of this anecdotal, but when we had a little bit more economy, a lot of the people coming to a homeless shelter were dealing with more immediate crises, a spouse losing a job that they were unprepared for, medical expenses you're unprepared for. We still have that, absolutely, but we're also, I'm hearing from our social service providers, there's just a lot more people and families dealing with long-term financial instability and long-term financial loss. Families that before were able to have steady jobs that are now sort of being introduced to poverty for the first time in generations, and their kids as well, versus, you know, they weren't families that had lived in poverty their entire time in Southern Illinois. So I think we're just seeing a lot of that and a lot of housing instability. We do have, of course, you know, public housing, HUD subsidized housing, but if you can't get in there, a lot of folks are then turning to our other affordable housing stock, which exists, and it may be to people in Chicago, they'll think $300-$400 is a steal, but a lot of the structures aren't safe, and there's other ways that landlords rope people into bad deals with contract for deeds that they're required to sign and all sorts of things that result in really bad situations when you have to go out house hunting without any sort of subsidy.
Yeah, that sounds really tough. Bob, Bob Palmer was also, I know, Bob, we were just talking about the whole idea of federal funding, and I know that depends a lot on getting an accurate headcount as well for the size of the homeless population that individual regions are serving. Betty, how big of a challenge is that for you in North Suburban Chicago to get an accurate headcount?
It's really tricky because even though we go out one night a year as directed by HUD, which is one of our federal funding sources, to count people who are living on the streets or living in shelter, we're only able to cover what places that we know people are kind of congregating. There's all sorts of folks who are what's called doubling up. So you go and stay at your friend's house for a couple weeks and then you can't stay there anymore. So that extreme housing instability is completely undercounted through that methodology of just going out one night a year in January.
And so would you consider this, Betty, I guess that there's, is this a question of whether it's like visible homeless populations versus invisible?
There's certainly an element of that. We serve about 1,500 people a year at Connections for the Homeless. About 10% of those are what are we think of as homeless, visibly homeless people who are living on the streets. Most people make it their full-time job to not let other people know that they're homeless if that's what they're experiencing. So that's that sort of element of just bouncing from place to place to place or staying in places without running water or without electricity and just trying to get to work every day and continue with your lives, get your kids to school, that sort of thing.
Erica, I think when people think about homelessness across the state, they are thinking of what Betty's saying of perhaps they have an image of their head of what that might look like, and they think that's confined to big cities like Chicago. I wonder how visible is this issue for you in Springfield?
Oh, it's actually very visible for us. We have a large population of people who are experiencing homelessness at our library right now, and it's very in your face in Springfield. So while I would definitely agree that there's a lot of invisible homelessness right now in our community, there are a lot of people sleeping on the pavement outside the library, on benches. We see a lot of people panhandling as well. Some of them are homeless, some not.
Erica, can you explain a little bit of the seasonality of this? Do we see this more as the weather gets warmer also, I guess?
Yes, we do. And in Springfield, it's because we've been very focused on emergency shelter, specifically around a seasonal shelter that we operate. So from November through March, there's a seasonal shelter. When that closes, people don't have anywhere to go, and they tend to – we've had 2 years where April has had really odd weather. Last year, it was very cold. This year, it was very wet. So what we would usually see is an out-migration to encampments that are invisible. People haven't been able to do what they usually would do, and so both years they've been stuck downtown.
Bob, it seems like there are lots of definitions of what it means to be homeless. I wonder how the government defines this.
Well, HUD, which provides most of the funding, has a narrow definition of homelessness. It's basically people who are literally homeless, you know, on the street in a shelter. There's other federal agencies like the Department of Education that do use a broader definition that does include those double deck families. For the competitively awarded money, though, HUD uses that more narrow definition, and this has been a big issue of sort of contention or disagreement nationally for many years now about whether that makes sense or not. The idea behind it is that it's those people who are kind of literally homeless on the street. They use most of the resources and shelters, emergency rooms, most likely to wind up in a psychiatric hospital or in a jail, and that we should focus our limited resources on them. And there's certainly a very good argument for that, but that makes it more challenging to use federal resources to serve, you know, families that are doubled up and other people who don't meet that narrow definition. Of course, it would all be solved if we had enough affordable housing and we wouldn't have to worry about what the definition of homelessness is. So that's what we're focused on.
And everyone keeps coming to back to that. So we have to take a break here. But after the break, we are going to get to this root problem of affordable housing. Bob, I know you've been in Springfield all week to talk about this issue. I want to hear what Housing Action Illinois thinks about this. Again, we're talking about this because of Molly Parker's story that she wrote in the Southern Illinoisan about one homeless shelter in Heron closing its doors. We'll tweet out Molly's story and we'll pick up this conversation on the other side of this short break. Tuning in, you're listening to The 21st, and I'm Nyla Boodoo, and we're talking about homelessness and the different ways you can define it, some of the challenges that shelters across Illinois are experiencing. Bob Palmer is with us with Housing Action Illinois. Bob, all of this keeps coming back to the issue of affordable housing, and I mentioned before the break that you were in Springfield this week. Last week, Governor Pritzker proposed a $41.5 billion construction plan. Most of that is roads. This is the capital plan that he's been talking about. Less than 0.5% of that was earmarked for affordable housing. What would you like to see from lawmakers, Bob?
Well, we were very pleased that Governor Pritzker included $175 million for affordable housing in his capital budget. We do have a greater ask that we're lobbying the General Assembly to move forward on, and that's actually for $1 billion in for affordable housing fund, and we realize that's an ambitious ask, but it really reflects the need that is out there. And if we had $1 billion, we could create 10,000 affordable rental homes across Illinois, and which would be great. It wouldn't address the need that all of it's out there, but it would make a significant dent.
Molly, when we're thinking about this issue of affordable housing, I know you spoke with someone who runs a shelter in Marion about this. What did she say?
She talked about exactly what some of the other folks on the call said, that you can house people in an emergency shelter all day long, but unless you can stabilize their housing situation, it's just a revolving door. And Southern Illinois experiences the same housing problems that other parts of the state and country do. And even though we're in a depressed economy, that also means wages are low. So matching income to housing, it's not just a big city problem. It very much is a rural problem as well.
And so that's how it looks at a rural area as we're thinking about Southern Illinois. Betty, I wonder if we can go all the way back up to the Chicago region and to the northern suburbs and what that looks like when you're doing this in a suburban Chicago context.
Yes. And, you know, the northern suburbs of Chicago are perceived as primarily affluent areas, and they certainly are. That puts a lot of pressure on the housing market. Rental costs are extremely high, and it's just becoming harder and harder for people to keep up with those costs. So that's where a lot of our prevention work comes in, providing small financial infusions into families so that they don't lose their homes in the first place. But as wages don't rise and rental costs do, it's imperative that we work as a region to address the issues of affordable housing. It can't be just one suburb does it all on their own. So in the 50 or so communities that we work in, each of them has different housing stock, different levels of income, different access to transportation and jobs and schools. So we're working on developing toolkits for those municipalities so that they can get started, each of them, on their own ways to address the crisis that's impending in their community.
Erica, how does this look in Springfield, and what kind of help do you want to see from lawmakers in the state house?
We definitely support the investment in affordable housing in our community. We would see that as a step forward and an important part of homelessness prevention. We also are very eager to increase the amount of permanent supportive housing, because permanent supportive housing really is the most effective approach for people who experience chronic homelessness. It gives them the support that they need to remain housed, because it's one thing to get someone in an apartment. It's another thing to keep them housed 3 months, 6 months, a year from now. Our local continuum has formed a permanent supportive housing task group, and we've engaged the city, the county, other agencies, businesses to really look at what can we do in our community to have a real solution to homelessness.
That's Erica Smith from Helping Hands in Springfield. I want to thank her, Betty Bogg from Connections for the Homeless in Evanston, Bob Palmer from Housing Action Illinois, and Molly Parker from the Southern Illinois. And guys, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's that time of year again. Hundreds of thousands of college students across the country are walking the stage, receiving their diplomas. Last week, seven incarcerated men at Stateville Correctional Center sported cap and gowns and received their bachelor's degrees through a free program at the prison. It was Statesville's first graduation ceremony in more than two decades and included a performance by Chicagoan Chance the Rapper, as well as speeches from Illinois Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton and activist Angela Davis. Tim Barnett is co-director of Higher Education for the Prison and Neighborhood Arts and Education Project. He also teaches at Northeastern Illinois University and is joining us now, along with Charles Preston, with Injustice Watch. He was in the crowd at the graduation ceremony last week, and Natalie Moore wrote about this for WBE. She's on the line with us now. Tim, Charles, Natalie, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Charles, can we start with what the mood was like at the ceremony?
I would say it was a very joyous mood. But it was also, like for me, it was very weird because after having gone through, like, security at a maximum security detention center, like, at a prison, and you walk through the prison, and then you come into seeing them staging graduation for the seven incarcerated men there. It was kind of a
real juxtaposition. Yeah, it sounds like,
yeah.
Right? Charles?
Yeah.
Natalie, I should point out the news media wasn't allowed to attend the ceremony. Why is that?
That's a very good question. I was told there wasn't enough room to accommodate all the press that wanted to be there.
Okay. And it's also, I imagine, Natalie, pretty rare for journalists to be allowed inside prisons in Illinois?
You know, I've been in prisons before for reporting. I was really surprised that the Illinois Department of Corrections didn't want to tout this as a positive story. You know, this is something that could have gotten the prison system different kind of press than what they typically get. So I think it was a missed opportunity.
Hmm. Tim, I wonder if you can tell us about this program, because these graduates completed a joint program between the NEIU Without Walls program, as well as the Prison and Neighborhood Arts and Education Project to get their diploma. How does this work? Each graduate has a specific area of study?
Yes, I'm an English professor at NEIU, but I've also been working with our non-traditional degree programs for about 3 years now. And we actually had eight students who started the program. One was transferred a few times, and he's supposed to graduate in this summer or fall. But the seven who graduated, students are eligible for the program basically through prior learning assessment. We determined that they've got substantial experience, knowledge, education. That can be from classes. It can be from independent study, legal work they've done, all kinds of things that we can basically give them some credit for so that they can get through their degrees somewhat more quickly based on their depth of knowledge.
And are they taking classes? Are these classes online? How does that work, Tim?
So it's complicated. I've been teaching inside at Stateville for about 4 or 5 years through the Prison Neighborhood Arts and Education Project. And Erica Miners and I, we sort of co-led this cohort through the University Without Walls program. We realized that there are many students who were incarcerated who were brilliant, self-taught, incredibly knowledgeable, who had helped write laws, who had influenced policy, who have read and written all kinds of things, published a lot. And we thought, you know, they'd be perfect candidates for a program that says, you know, if you can demonstrate knowledge, whether it's through formal classes or through PNAP classes, which are not always credited, in fact, haven't been up till now, and we can verify that level of knowledge, then you are a good fit for the program. And we had started an application process. We had many students who would have fit, and we picked the top eight.
And then you had eight, and then did you say you had eight? How many of those graduated?
Seven graduated. One man, Philip Hartsfield, was moved from Stateville last year, and he's moved around a bit, and he should be scheduled to graduate either summer or next fall.
Well, that's a pretty impressive graduation rate, Tim. I wonder, Natalie.
They're dedicated.
Yeah. Natalie, you had a chance to speak with keynote speaker Angela Davis. What did she say about why she wanted to be part of this ceremony?
She said that she wanted to participate because to her, education within prison is important. And she thought that the fact that this graduation happened indicated not only the achievement of the individuals who received their degrees, but it was also an indication of the success of struggles that have taken place all over the country, you know, with prison reform, with prison education. I know the others can talk about what she actually said there, but you know, I talked to her right after the ceremony, and she said that she wanted those graduates to know that they are productive citizens who can participate in the remaking of society.
Charles, was that conveyed during Angela Davis's speech at the ceremony?
Almost definitely. Angela Davis, she talked about a host of things that, you know, her being a prison abolitionist, she even questioned the necessity for prisons, which was like, I was kind of like, it was a jaw-dropping moment for me because there she is in the middle of a prison questioning the necessity for them, but also talking about how prison has moved from like rehabilitation to more of a punitive type of place where we just keep our people who've been criminalized.
And Nyla,
go ahead, Natalie.
Just add too that a couple of years ago, I was a speaker in a class, one of the PNAP classes, a writing class. It was probably one of the most amazing things that I did that year.
Working with that class, Natalie?
Yeah, it was just a one time. Like, I wasn't teaching the class. I was a guest speaker. You know, Charles talked about what it's like to even get into the prison for women. It's even tougher. They're very strict about what you can wear, what you can't wear. It's a very invasive process to get in. But the men who were in that class were incredibly smart, well-read, and, you know, they want to be there. Not in prison. They want to be
in the class. Sure.
Learning, yes.
So, Tim, as we're thinking about everyone talking about this, why was this the first time that this graduation happened in more than two decades, when it sounds like the folks who were there really want to be there, the people who are involved really want to teach them? Where is the disconnect here?
I mean, I think some of it is the history. Most of us know about the ending of Pell Grants in 1994, I think it was, under the Clinton administration. And so there's little opportunity for people who can't afford college tuition themselves to pay for college tuition. And so there were a number of programs at Stateville before the 90s, including NEIU and including University Without Walls. But really since from 1994, roughly until about 7 years ago, when DePaul and PNAP started working at Stateville, there was very little. There was Christian ministry programs. There's a GED program. But really there's been growth, not just DePaul and Northeastern, but Northwestern University has started a great program and North Park University as well. But I also think Charles's point is really worth taking, that we really are a system that's punitive and not rehabilitative. And, you know, I would just speak to one thing we hear from our students all the time, speaking about various things or various benefits, is that violence, in their view, has gone down tremendously in the past 7 years since they've had real programs that make them think and that students are striving to get into. There's less violence against COs. There's less violence among the men. They're inspiring their families. A lot of the family members came to our official NEIU graduation, which was held in downtown Chicago 2 weeks ago, just to hear their sons' names called. So there's a lot of ripple effects that I would like or wish that people would know more about, but I think we're still stuck in that retribution mode.
Tim, just very quickly, what would you like to see as we're thinking about IDOC, the state government investments? I imagine you'd like to see a lot more. Are you hopeful about some recent changes that have been announced in that realm?
It's been an interesting time with all the changes. And so I'm hopeful. I think the new administration is more friendly towards higher education. We certainly felt the brunt of it at NEIU from the last administration, but that's, of course, linked to what's happening at the prison. So we're kind of hopeful that higher education, public higher education, will be better funded, that there'll be more opportunities to work within the prisons. One major thing we're running up against right now, and again, this is based on there's Northwestern, North Park, DePaul, and PNAP, which is a coalition of people. In the last 3 years, there's been an expansion, a great expansion at Stateville. They're running out of places to put us, not because they don't have space, but because they don't have enough security to guarantee, I guess, that we can have those classes. So there are empty rooms, and we do have teachers, professors, faculty from multiple universities trying to get in there to teach, but administratively and security-wise and in other ways, it's very, very difficult to make it work. So our first step, I think, is to kind of push on that and maybe shift, hopefully get people to shift resources to more security for education in particular.
That's Timothy Barnett, co-director of Higher Education for Prison and the Neighborhood Arts and Education Project. I want to thank him, along with Charles Preston, who attended this graduation and works for Injustice Watch, and Natalie Moore, who reported on this for WBEZ. As we say thank you and goodbye to you guys, I thought we'd play a little bit of Chance the Rapper, who did perform at the Stateville graduation. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And here's Chance's song, Blessings. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening.
Are you ready? 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 Are you ready?
It seems like blessings keep falling in my lap.